I need a witness. That's it. You're like a salmon swimming upstream, Lev offers. It's inside you to do it, and it's inside me to help you get there. Salmon. Sai looks thoughtful. I once saw this poster about a salmon. It was jumping up this waterfall, see? But there was a bear at the top, and this fish, it was jumping right into the bear's mouth. The caption beneath, it was supposed to be funny, said, The journey of 1,000 miles sometimes ends very, very badly. There's no bear in Joplin, Lev tells him. He doesn't try to cheer Sai up with any more analogies, because Sai's so smart, he can find a way to make anything sound bad. 130 IQ points all focused on cooking up doom. Lev can't hope to compete with that. The days go by mile, town by town, until the afternoon they pass a sign that says, Now entering Joplin, population 45,504. 30. Sai Tai. There is no peace in Sci-Fi's head. The fry doesn't know how bad it is. The fry doesn't know how the feelings crash over him like storm-driven waves pounding a failing seawall. The wall is going to collapse soon, and when it does, Sai will lose it. He'll lose everything. His mind will spill out of his ears and down the drains of the streets of Joplin. He knows it. Then he sees the sign. Now entering Joplin. His heart is his own, but it pounds in his chest, threatening to burst. And wouldn't that be a fine thing? They'd rush him to a hospital, give him someone else's ticker, and he'd have that kid to deal with, too. This boy in the corner of his head doesn't talk to him in words. He feels. He emotes. He doesn't understand that he's only a part of another kid. It's like how in a dream you know some things, and other things you should know, but you don't. This kid, he knows where he is, but he doesn't know he's not all here. He doesn't know he's part of someone else now. He keeps looking for things in Cyrus's head that just aren't there. Memories. Connections. He keeps looking for words, but Cyrus's brain codes words differently, and so the kid hurls out anger, terror, grief. Waves pounding the wall, and beneath it all, there's a current tugging Sai forward. Something must be done here. Only the kid knows what it is. Would it help to have a map? Asks the fry. The question gets Sai mad. Map won't help me, he says. I need to see stuff. I need to be places. Map is just a map. It ain't being there. They stand at a corner on the outskirts of Joplin. It's like divining for water. Nothing looks familiar. He doesn't know this place, Sai says. Let's try another street. Block after block, intersection after intersection, it's the same. Nothing. Joplin is a small town, but not so small that a person could know all of it. Then, at last, they get to a main street. There are shops and restaurants up and down the road. It's just like any other town this size, but...
Wait.
What is it?
He knows this street, says Sai.
There, that ice cream shop.
I can taste pumpkin ice cream. I hate pumpkin ice cream.
I'll bet he didn't. Cyrus nods.
It was his favorite.
The loser. He points a finger at the ice cream shop and slowly swings his arm to the left.
He comes walking from that direction.
He swings his arm to the right.
And when he's done, he goes that way.
So do we track where he comes from or where he goes? Sai chooses to go left, but finds himself at Joplin High, home of the Eagles. He gets an image of a sword and instantly knows.
Fencing! The kid was on the fencing team here.
Swords are shiny, the fry notes. Sai would throw him a dirty look if he weren't right on target. Swords are indeed shiny. He wonders if the kid ever stole swords, and realizes that yes, he probably did. Stealing the swords of opposing teams is a time-honored tradition of fencing.
This way, says the fry, taking the lead. He must have gone from school to the ice cream shop to home. Home is where we're going, right?
The answer comes to Sai as an urge deep in his brain that shoots straight to his gut.
Salmon? More like a swordfish twisting on a line, and that line is pulling him relentlessly toward... home, says Sai. Right. It's twilight now. Kids are out in the street. Half the cars have headlights on. As far as anyone knows, they're just two neighborhood kids, heading wherever neighborhood kids go. No one seems to notice them. But there's a police car a block away. It was parked, but now it begins moving. They pass the ice cream parlor, and as they do, Cyrus can feel the change inside him. It's in his walk, and in the way he holds himself. It's in all the tension points of his face. They're changing. His eyebrows lower, his jaw opens slightly. I'm not myself. That other kid has taken over. Should Sai let it happen, or should he fight it? But he knows it's already past the point of fighting. The only way to finish this is to let it happen. Sai, says the kid next to him. Sai looks at him, and although part of him knows it's just Lev, another part of him panics. He instantly knows why. He closes his eyes for a moment and tries to convince the kid in his head that the Fry is a friend, not a threat. The kid seems to get it, and his panic drops a notch. Sai reaches a corner and turns left like he's done it 100 times. The rest of him shudders as he tries to keep up with his determined temporal lobe. Now a feeling comes on him, nervous, annoyed. He knows he must find a way to translate it into words. I'm gonna be late. They're gonna be so mad. They're always so mad.
Late for what?
Dinner. They gotta eat it right on time or I get hell for it. They could eat it without me, but they won't. They don't. They just stew, and the food goes cold, and it's my fault. My fault. Always my fault. So I gotta sit there, and they ask me, how was my day? Fine. What did I learn? Nothing. What did I do wrong this time? Everything.
It's not his voice. It's his vocal cords, but it's not his voice coming out of them. Same tones, but different inflections, a different accent. Like the way he might have talked if he came from Joplin, home of the Eagles. As they turn another corner, Sai catches sight of that cop car again. It's behind them, following slowly. No mistake about it, it's following. And that's not all. There's another police car up ahead, but that one's just waiting in front of a house. His house.
My house.
Sai is the salmon after all, and that police car is the bear. But even so, he can't stop. He's got to get to that house, or die trying. As he nears the front walk, two men get out of a familiar Toyota parked across the street. It's the dads. They look at him, relief in their faces, but also pain. So they knew where he was coming. They must have known all along.
Cyrus? One of them calls.
He wants to run to them. He wants them to just take him home, but he stops himself. He can't go home. Not yet. They both stride toward him, getting in his path, but smart enough not to get in his face.
I gotta do this,
he says in a voice he knows isn't his at all. That's when the police leap from their cars and grab him. They're too strong for him to fight them off, so he looks at the dads.
I gotta do this, he says again. Don't be the bear.
They look at each other, not understanding what he means. But then, maybe they do, because they step aside and say to the cops,
Let him go. This is Lev,
Cyrus says, amazed that the Fry is willing to risk his own safety to stand by Sai now.
Nobody bothers him, either.
The dads take a brief moment to acknowledge the Fry, but quickly return their attention to Cyrus. The cops frisk Sai to make sure he has no weapon, and, satisfied, they let him go on toward the house. But there is a weapon. It's something sharp and heavy. Right now it's just in a corner of his mind, but in a few moments it won't be. And now Sai's scared, but he can't stop. There's a police officer at the front door talking in hushed tones to a man and a woman standing at the threshold. They glance nervously at Sai. The part of Sai that isn't Sai knows this middle-aged couple so well. He's hit by a lightning bolt of emotions so violent he feels like he'll incinerate.
As he walks toward the door, the flagstone path seems to undulate beneath his feet like a funhouse floor. Then, finally, he's standing before them. The couple look scared, horrified. Part of him is happy at that, part of him sad, and part of him wishes he could be any place else in the world, but he no longer knows which part is which. He opens his mouth to speak, trying to translate the feelings into words.
"Give it,"
he demands.
"Give it to me, Mom. Give it to me, Dad."
The woman covers her mouth and turns away. She presses out tears like she's a sponge in a fist.
"Tyler?"
says the man.
"Tyler, is that you?"
It's the first time Cyrus has a name to go with that part of him.
"Tyler. Yes, I'm Cyrus, but I'm also Tyler. I'm Cy-Ty."
"Hurry," Cy-Ty says.
"Give it to me. I need it now."
"What? Tyler?"
says the woman through her tears.
"What do you want from us?"
Cy-Ty tries to say it, but he can't get the word. He can't even get the image straight. It's a thing, a weapon. Still, the image won't come, but the action does. He's miming something. He leans forward, puts one arm in front of the other. He's holding something long, angling it down. He thrusts both arms lower. And now he knows it's not a weapon he seeks. It's a tool. Because he understands the action he's miming. He's digging.
"Shovel,"
he says with a breath of relief.
"I need the shovel."
The man and woman look at each other. The policeman beside them nods, and the man says,
"It's out in the shed."
Cy-Ty makes a beeline through the house and out the back door with everyone following behind him, the couple, the cops, the dads, and the fry. He heads straight for the shed, grabs the shovel, he knew exactly where it was, and heads toward a corner of the yard where some twigs stick out of the ground. The twigs have been tied to form lopsided crosses. Cy-Ty knows this corner of the yard. He feels this place in his gut. This is where he buried his pets. He doesn't know their names or even what kind of animals they were, but he suspects one of them was an Irish setter. He gets images of what happened to each of them. One met up with a pack of wild dogs, another with a bus, the third, old age. He takes the shovel and thrusts it into the ground, but not near any of their graves. He's never disturbed them, never. Instead, he presses his shovel into the soft earth 2 yards behind the graves. He grunts with every thrust of the shovel, hurling the dirt wildly to the side. Then, at just about 2 feet down, the shovel hits something with a dull thud. He drops to all fours and begins scooping out the earth with his hands. With the dirt cleared away, he reaches in, grabs a handle, and tugs, tugs, tugs until it comes up. He's holding a briefcase that's waterlogged and covered with mud. He puts it on the ground, flicks open the latches, and opens it. The moment he sees what's inside, Cy-Ty's entire brain seizes. He's frozen in a total system lockup. He can't move, can't think, because it's all so bright, so shiny in the slanted red rays of the sun. There are so many pretty things to look at, he can't move. But he must move. He must finish this. He digs both of his hands into the jewelry-filled briefcase, feeling the fine gold chain slide over his hands, hearing the rattle of metal against metal. There are diamonds and rubies, zircons and plastic, the priceless and the worthless, all mixed in together. He doesn't remember where or when he stole any of it. He only knows that he did. He stole it, hoarded it, and hid it. Put it in its own little grave to dig up when he needed it. But if he can give it back, then maybe. With hands tangled in gold chains more binding than the handcuffs on the policeman's belts, he stumbles toward the man and woman. Bits and pieces, rings and pins fall from the tangled bundle into the brush of the yard. They slip through his fingers. But still he holds on to what he can until he's there in front of the man and woman, who now hold each other as if cowering in the path of a tornado. Then he falls to his knees, drops the bundle of shiny things at their feet, and, rocking back and forth, makes a desperate plea.
Please, he says. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I didn't mean it. Please, he says. Take it. I don't need it. I don't want it. Please, he says. Do anything, but don't unwind me.
And all at once, Cy realizes that Tyler doesn't know. The part of that boy which comprehends time and place isn't here, and never will be. Tyler can't understand that he's already gone, and nothing Cy can do will ever make him understand. So he goes on wailing.
Please don't unwind me. I'll do anything. Please don't unwind me. Please.
Then, behind him, he hears a voice. 31. Lev.
Tell him what he needs to hear, Lev says.
He stands there with such wrath in him he feels the earth itself will split from his anger. He told Cy he'd witness this, but he can't witness it and not take action. Tyler's parents still huddle together, comforting each other instead of comforting Cy. It makes Lev even more furious.
Tell him you won't unwind him, he screams.
The man and woman just look at him like stupid rabbits. So he grabs the shovel from the ground and swings it back over his shoulder like a baseball bat.
Tell him you won't unwind him or I swear I'll bash your worthless heads in.
He's never spoken like this to anyone. He's never threatened anyone. And he knows it's not just a threat. He'll do it. Today, he'll hit a grand slam if he has to. The cops reach for their holsters and pull out their guns, but Lev doesn't care.
Drop the shovel,
one of them yells. His gun is trained at Lev's chest, but Lev won't drop it.
Let him shoot. If he does, I'll still get in one good swing at Tyler's parents before I go down. I might die, but at least I'll take one of them with me.
In his whole life, he's never felt like this before. He's never felt this close to exploding.
Tell him! Tell him now!
Everything freezes in the standoff. The cops and their guns, Lev and his shovel. Then finally, the man and woman end it. They look down at the boy rocking back and forth, sobbing over the random pieces of tangled jewelry he spread at their feet.
We won't unwind you, Tyler.
Promise him!
We won't unwind you, Tyler. We promise. We promise.
Cy's shoulders relax, and although he still cries, they're no longer sobs of desperation. They're sobs of relief.
Thank you,
Cy says.
Thank you.
Lev drops the shovel. The cops lower their guns, and the tearful couple escape toward the safety of their home. Cyrus's dads are there to fill the void. They help Cyrus up and hold him tight.
It's all right, Cyrus. Everything's going to be okay.
And through his sobs, Cy says,
I know. It's all good now. It's all good.
That's when Lev takes off. He knows he's the only variable in this equation left to resolve, and in a moment the cops are going to realize that. So he backs into the shadows while the officers are still distracted by the scurrying couple and the crying kid and the two dads and the shiny things on the ground. Then, once he's in the shadows, he turns and runs. In a few moments they'll know he's gone, but a few moments is all he needs, because he's fast. He's always been fast. He's through the bushes, into the next yard, and onto another street in 10 seconds. The look on Cy's face as he dropped the jewelry at the feet of those horrible, horrible people, and the way they acted, as if they were the ones being victimized. These things will stay with Lev for the rest of his life. He knows he's been changed by this moment, transformed in some deep and frightening way. Wherever his journey now takes him, it doesn't matter, because he has already arrived there in his heart. He's become like that briefcase in the ground, full of gems yet void of light, so nothing sparkles, nothing shines. The last bit of daylight is gone from the sky now. The only color left is a dark blue fading to black. The street lights have not yet come on, so Lev dodges through endless shades of pitch. The better to run, the better to hide, the better to lose himself now that darkness is his friend.
Part 5. Graveyard.
Southwest Arizona serves as an ideal graveyard for airplanes. It has a dry, clear, and virtually smog-free climate that helps minimize corrosion. It has an alkaline soil so firm that planes can be towed and parked on the surface without sinking. An airplane graveyard is not just a fence around airplane carcasses and piles of scrap metal. Rather, many millions of dollars worth of surplus parts are salvaged to keep active aircraft flying. Joe Zentner, Airplane Graveyards, DesertUSA.com. 32. The Admiral. The blazing sun bakes the Arizona hardpan by day, and the temperature plunges at night. More than 4,000 planes from every era of aviation history shine in the heat of that sun. From cruising altitude, the rows of planes look like crop lines, a harvest of abandoned technology.
Number one, you arrived here by necessity. You stay here by choice.
From way up there, you can't see that some of those grounded jets are occupied. 33, to be exact. Spy satellites can catch the activity, but catching it and noticing it are two different things. CIA data analysts have far more pressing things to look for than a band of refugee unwinds. This is what the Admiral's counting on. But just in case, the rules in the graveyard are strict. All activity takes place in the fuselage or under the wings, unless it's absolutely necessary to go out into the open. The heat helps enforce the edict.
Number two, surviving has earned you the right to be respected.
The Admiral doesn't exactly own the graveyard, but his management is undisputed, and he answers to no one but himself. A combination of business sense, favors owed, and a military willing to do anything to get rid of him are what made such a sweet deal possible.
Number three, my way is the only way.
The graveyard is a thriving business. The Admiral buys decommissioned airplanes and sells the parts, or even resells them whole. Most business is done online. The Admiral is able to acquire about one retired jet a month. Of course, each one arrives loaded with a secret cargo of unwinds. That's the real business of the graveyard, and business has been good.
Number four, your life is my gift to you. Treat it like one.
Buyers do, on occasion, come to inspect or to pick up merchandise. But there's always plenty of warning. From the time they enter the gate, it's 5 miles to the yard itself. It gives the kids more than enough time to disappear like gremlins into the machinery. These types of business-related visitors come only about once a week. There are people who wonder what the Admiral does with all the rest of his time. He tells them he's building a wildlife preserve.
Number five, you are better than those who would unwind you. Rise to the occasion.
There are only 3 adults in the Admiral's employ, 2 office workers stationed in a trailer far from the unwinds, and a helicopter pilot. The pilot goes by the name of Cleaver, and he has 2 jobs. The first is to tour important buyers around the lot in style. The second is to take the Admiral on trips around the graveyard once a week. Cleaver is the only employee who knows about the hoard of unwinds sequestered in the far reaches of the lot. He knows, but he's paid more than enough to keep quiet. And besides, the Admiral trusts Cleaver implicitly. One must trust one's personal pilot.
Number six, everyone in the graveyard contributes. No exceptions.
The real work in the yard is done by the unwinds. There are whole teams specially designated to strip the jets, sort parts, and get them ready for sale. It's just like any other junkyard, but on a larger scale. Not all the jets get stripped. Some remain untouched, if the Admiral thinks he can resell them whole. Some are retooled as living quarters for the kids who are, both literally and figuratively, under his wing.
Number seven. Teenage rebellion is for suburban school children. Get over it.
The kids are grouped in teams best suited for their jobs, their ages, and their personal needs. A lifetime of experience molding military buffs into a coherent fighting force has prepared the Admiral for creating a functional society out of angry, troubled kids.
Number eight.
Hormones will not rule my desert. Girls are never grouped with boys. Number 9, at 18 you cease to be my concern. The Admiral has a list of his 10 supreme rules posted in each and every plane where kids live and work. The kids call them the 10 Commandments. He doesn't care what they call them, as long as each and every one of them knows the list by heart. Number 10. Make something of yourself. This is an order. It's a challenge keeping almost 400 kids healthy, hidden, and whole, but the Admiral has never walked away from a challenge. And his motivation for doing this, like his name, is something he prefers to keep to himself.
33. Risa. For Risa, the first days in the graveyard are harsh and seem to last forever. Her residency begins with an exercise in humility. Each new arrival is required to face a tribunal. 3 17-year-olds sitting behind a desk in the gutted shell of a wide-body jet. 2 boys and a girl. These 3, together with Amp and Jeeves, who Risa met when she first stepped off the plane, make up the elite group of 5 everyone calls the Goldens. They're the Admiral's 5 most trusted kids, and therefore the ones in charge. By the time they get to Risa, they've already processed 40 kids.
Tell us about yourself, says the boy on the right. Starboard boy, she calls him, since, after all, they're in a vessel.
What do you know? And what can you do?
The last tribunal Risa faced was back at Steho, when she was sentenced to be unwound. She can tell these 3 are bored and don't care what she says, just as long as they can get on to the next one. She finds herself hating them, just as she hated the headmaster that day he tried to explain why her membership in the human race had been revoked. The girl, who sits in the middle, must read her feelings because she smiles and says,
"Don't worry, this isn't a test. We just want to help you find where you'll fit in here."
It's an odd thing to say, since not fitting in is every unwind's problem. Risa takes a deep breath.
"I was a music student at Steho," she says, then immediately regrets telling them she's from a state home.
Even among unwinds, there's prejudice and pecking orders. Sure enough, Starboard leans back, crossing his arms in clear disapproval. But the port side boy says,
"I'm a ward too. Florida Steho 18. Ohio 23. "What instrument do you play?" the girl asks. "Classical piano?"
"Sorry," says Starboard. "We got enough musicians, and none of the planes came with the piano."
"Survival has earned me the right to be respected," Risa says. "Isn't that one of the Admiral's rules? I don't think he'd like your attitude."
Starboard squirms. "Can we just get on with this?"
The girl offers an apologetic grin.
"As much as I hate to admit it, in the here and now, there are other things we need before a virtuoso. What else can you do? Just give me a job and I'll do it,"
Risa says, trying to get this over with.
"That's what you're going to do anyway, right?"
"Well, you always need help in the galley," says Starboard, "especially after meals."
The girl gives Risa a long, pleading look, perhaps hoping that Risa will come up with something better for herself. But all Risa says is,
"Fine, dishwasher, am I done here?"
She turns to leave, doing her best to douse her disgust. The next kid comes in as she's heading out. He looks awful. His nose is swollen and purple, his shirt is caked with dried blood, and both his nostrils have started bleeding fresh.
"What happened to you?"
He looks at her, sees who it is, and says,
"Your boyfriend? That's what happened to me. And he's gonna pay."
Risa could ask him a dozen questions about that, but the kid's bleeding all over his shirt, and the first priority is to stop it. He tips his head back.
"No," Risa tells him. "Lean forward, otherwise you'll gag on your own blood."
The kid listens. The tribunal of 3 come out from behind their desk to see what they can do, but Risa has it under control.
"Pinch it like this," she tells him. "You need to be patient with this kind of thing."
She shows the kid exactly how to pinch his nose to stem the flow of blood. Then, once the bleeding stops, Portside comes over to her and says, "Nice work." She's immediately promoted from dishwasher to medic. Funny, but it's indirectly Connor's doing, since he's the one who broke that kid's nose in the first place.
As for the kid with the bloody nose, he gets assigned to dishwashing. The first few days, actually trying to act like a medic without any real training is terrifying. There are other kids in the medical jet who seem to know a lot more, but she quickly comes to realize they were thrown into this just like she was when they first arrived. "You'll do fine. You're a natural," the senior medic, who is all of 17, tells her. He's right. Once she gets used to the idea, handling first aid, standard illnesses, and even suturing simple wounds becomes as familiar to her as playing the piano. The days begin to pass quickly, and before she realizes it, she's been there a month. Each day that goes by adds to her sense of security. The Admiral was an odd bird, but he'd done something no one else had been able to do for her since she'd left Stay-Ho. He'd given her back her right to exist. 34. Connor. Like Risa, Connor finds his niche by accident. Connor never considered himself mechanically capable, but there are few things he can stand less than a bunch of morons standing around looking at something that doesn't work and wondering who's going to fix it. During that first week, while Risa's off learning how to be an exceptionally good fake doctor, Connor decides to figure out the workings of a fried air conditioning unit, then find replacement parts from one of the junk piles and get it working again. He soon comes to realize it's the same way with every other broken thing he comes across. Sure, it began with trial and error, but the errors become fewer and fewer as the days go by. There are plenty of other kids who claim to be mechanics, and are really good at explaining why things won't work. Connor, on the other hand, actually fixes them. It quickly gets him reassigned from trash duty to the repair crew, and since there are endless things to repair, it keeps his mind off of other things, such as how little he gets to see Risa in the Admiral's tightly structured world, and how quickly Roland is advancing through the social ranks of the place. Roland has managed to get himself one of the best assignments in the graveyard. By working the angles and applying plenty of flattery, he's been taken on as the pilot's assistant. Mostly, he just keeps the helicopter cleaned and fueled, but the assignment reeks of an apprenticeship.
"He's teaching me how to fly it," he overhears Roland tell a bunch of other kids one day.
Connor shudders to think of Roland behind the controls of a helicopter, but many kids are impressed by Roland. His age gives him seniority, and his manipulations gain him either fear or respect from a surprising number of others. Roland draws his negative energy from the kids around him, and there are a lot of kids here for him to draw from. Social manipulation is not one of Connor's strengths. Even among his own team, he's a bit of a mystery. Kids know not to tread on him because he has a low tolerance for irritation and idiocy. But there's no one they'd rather have on their side than Connor.
"People like you because you've got integrity," Hayden tells him, "even when you're being an ass."
Connor has to laugh at that. Him? Integrity? There have been plenty of people in Connor's life who would think differently. But on the other hand, he's changing. He's been getting into fewer fights. Maybe it's because there's more room to breathe here than in the warehouse. Or maybe he's been working out his brain enough for it to successfully muscle his impulses into line. A lot of that has to do with Risa, because every time he forces himself to think before acting, it's her voice in his head telling him to slow down. He wants to tell her, but she's always so busy in the medical jet. And you don't just go to somebody and say, "I'm a better person because you're in my head." She's also still in Roland's head, and that worries Connor. At first, Risa had been a tool to provoke Connor into a fight, but now Roland sees her as a prize. Now, instead of using brute strength against her, he tries to charm her at every turn.
"You're not actually falling for him, are you?" he asks her one day, on one of the rare occasions he can get her alone.
"I'll pretend you didn't just ask that,"
she tells him in disgust. But Connor has reasons to wonder.
"On that first night here, he offered you his blanket, and you accepted it," he points out. "Only because I knew it would make him cold."
"And when he offers you his food, you take it, because it means he goes hungry."
It's coolly logical. Connor finds it amazing that she can put her emotions aside and be as calculating as Roland, beating him at his own game. Another reason for Connor to admire her.
"Work call!"
It happens about once a week beneath the meeting canopy. the only structure in the entire graveyard that isn't part of a plane, and the only place large enough to gather all 423 kids. Work call. A chance to get out into the real world. A chance to have a life. Sort of. The Admiral never attends, but there are video feeds from the meeting canopy, just as there are feeds all over the yard, so everyone knows he's watching. Whether or not every camera is constantly monitored, no one knows, but the potential for being seen is always there. Connor did not care for the Admiral the first day he met him. The sight of all those video cameras shortly thereafter made Connor like him even less. It seems each day there's something to add to his general feeling of disgust with the man. Amp leads the work call meeting with his megaphone and clipboard. "A man in Oregon needs a team of 5 to clear-cut a few acres of forest," Amp announces. "You'll be given room and board and taught to use the tools of the trade. The job should take a few months, and at the end you'll get new identities, 18-year-old identities." Amp doesn't let them know the salary, because there is none. The Admiral gets paid, though. He gets paid a purchase price. "Any takers?" There are always takers. Sure enough, more than a dozen hands go up. 16-year-olds, mostly. 17s are too close to 18 to make it worth their while, and younger kids are too intimidated by the prospect. "Report to the Admiral after this meeting. He'll make the final decision as to who goes." Work call infuriates Connor. He never puts his hand up, even if it's something he might actually want to do. "The Admiral's using us," he says to the kids around him. "Don't you see that?" Most of the kids just shrug. But Hayden's there, and he never misses an opportunity to add his peculiar wisdom to a situation. "I'd rather be used whole than in pieces," Hayden says. Amp looks at his clipboard and holds up the megaphone again. "House cleaning services," he says. 3 are needed. Female preferred, no false IDs, but the location is secure and remote, which means you'll be safe from the juvie cops until you turn 18. Connor won't even look. "Please tell me no one raised their hand." "About 6 girls. All 17-year-olds, it looks like," says Hayden. "I guess no one wants to be a house girl for more than a year." "This place isn't a refuge. It's a slave market. Why doesn't anyone see that?" "Who says they don't see it? It's just that unwinding makes slavery look good. It's always the lesser of two evils." "I don't see why there have to be any evils at all." As the meeting breaks up, Connor feels a hand on his shoulder. He thinks it must be a friend, but it's not. It's Roland. It's such a surprise, it takes Connor a moment before he reacts. He shakes Roland's hand off. "Something you want?" "Just to talk." "Don't you have a helicopter to wash?" Roland smiles at that. "Less washing, more flying. Cleaver made me his unofficial co-pilot." Cleaver must have a death wish. Connor doesn't know who he's more disgusted with, Roland or the pilot for being suckered in by him. Roland looks around at the thinning crowd. "The Admiral's got some racket going here, doesn't he?" he says. "Most of the losers here don't care. But it bothers you, doesn't it?" "Your point?" "Just that you're not the only one who thinks the Admiral needs some retraining." Connor doesn't like where this is going. "What I think of the Admiral is my business." "Of course it is. Have you seen his teeth, by the way?"
"What about them?"
"Pretty obvious that they're not his. I hear he keeps a picture of the kid he got them from in his office, an unwind like us, who, thanks to him, never made it to 18. Makes you wonder how much more of him comes from us. Makes you wonder if there's anything left of the original Admiral at all." This is too much information to process here and now, and considering the source, Connor doesn't want to process it at all, but he knows he will. "Roland, let me make this as clear to you as I can. I don't trust you. I don't like you. I don't want to have anything to do with you."
"I can't stand you either,"
Roland says, and he points to the Admiral's jet.
"But right now, we've got the same enemy."
Roland strolls off before anyone else can take notice of their conversation, leaving Connor with a heaviness in his stomach. The very idea that he and Roland could in any way be on the same side
makes him feel like he swallowed something rancid. For a week, the seed that Roland planted in Connor's brain grows. It's fertile ground, because Connor already distrusted the Admiral. Now, every time he sees the man, Connor notices something. His teeth are perfect. They're not the teeth of an aging war veteran. The way he looks at people, looking into their eyes, it's as if he were sizing those eyes up, looking for a pair that might suit him. And those kids that disappear on work calls, since they never come back, who's to know where they really go? Who's to say they don't all get sent off to be unwound? The Admiral says his goal is to save Unwinds. But what if he's got an entirely different agenda? These thoughts keep Connor awake at night, but he won't share them with anyone, because once he does, it aligns him with Roland, and that's an alliance he never wants to make. During their fourth week in the graveyard, while Connor is still building his case against the Admiral in his own mind, a plane arrives. It's the first one since the old FedEx jet that brought them here, and like that jet, this one is packed full of live cargo. While the five Goldens march the new arrivals from their jet, Connor works on a faulty generator. He watches them with mild interest as they pass, wondering if any of them would be more mechanically skilled than him and bump him into a less enviable position. Then, toward the back of the line of kids is a face he thinks he recognizes. Someone from home? No, someone else. All at once it comes to him who this is. It's the boy he was sure had been unwound weeks ago. It's the kid he kidnapped for his own good. It's Lev. Connor drops his wrench and runs toward him, but gains control before he gets there, burying his mixed flood of feelings beneath a calm saunter. This is the kid who betrayed him. This is the kid he once swore he'd never forgive. And yet the thought of him unwound had been too much to bear. But Lev hasn't been unwound. He's right here, marching off to the supply jet. Connor is thrilled. Connor is furious. Lev doesn't see him yet, and that's fine because it gives Connor some time to take in what he sees. This is no longer the clean-cut tithe he pulled out of his parents' car more than 2 months before. This kid has long, unkempt hair and a hardened look about him. This kid isn't in tithing whites, but wears torn jeans and a dirty red t-shirt. Connor wants to let him pass, just so he can have time to process this new image, but Lev sees him, and gives him a grin right away. This is also different, because during that brief time they knew each other, Lev had never been pleased by Connor's presence. Lev steps toward him. "Stay in line," orders Amp. "The supply jet's this way." But Connor waves Amp off. "It's okay, I know this one." Amp reluctantly gives in. Make sure he gets to the supply jet. Then he returns to herding the others. "So how are things?" says Lev. Just like that. How are things? You'd think they were buds back from summer vacation. Connor knows what he has to do. It's the only thing that will ever make things right between him and Lev. Once again, it's instinctive action without time for thought. Instinctive, not irrational. Impassioned, but not impulsive. Connor has come to know the difference. He hauls off and punches Lev in the eye. Not hard enough to knock him down, but hard enough to snap his head halfway around and give him a nasty shiner. Before Lev can react, Connor says, "That's for what you did to us." Then, before Lev can respond, he does something else sudden and unexpected. He pulls Lev toward him and hugs him tightly. The way he hugged his own little brother last year when he took first place in the district pentathlon. "I'm really, really glad you're alive, Lev."
"Yeah, me too."
He lets Lev go before it starts feeling awkward, and when he does, he can see Lev's eye is already beginning to swell, and an idea occurs to him. "Come on, I'll take you over to the medical jet. I know someone who'll take care of that eye." It isn't until later that night that Connor gets an inkling of how much Lev has truly changed. Connor is shaken awake sometime during the night. He opens his eyes to a flashlight shining in his face, so close the light hurts.
"Hey, what is this?"
"Shh," says a voice behind the flashlight. It's Lev. Lev should have been in the newcomer's jet,
That's where all the kids go until they get sorted into their teams. There are strict orders that no one is to be out at night. Apparently Lev is no longer a boy bound by rules.
What are you doing here?
Connor says.
Do you know the trouble you could be in?
He still can't see Lev's face behind that flashlight.
You hit me this afternoon,
says Lev.
I hit you because I owed that to you.
I know. I deserved it, and so it's okay, says Lev.
But don't you ever hit me again, or you'll regret it.
Although Connor has no intention of ever punching Lev out again, he does not respond well to ultimatums.
I'll hit you, Connor says, if you deserve it.
Silence from behind the flashlight. Then Lev says,
fair enough, but you better make sure that I do.
The light goes off. Lev leaves, but Connor can't sleep. Every unwind has a story you don't want to know. He supposes that Lev now has his. The Admiral calls for Connor 2 days later. Apparently, he has something in need of repair. His residence is an old 747 that was used as Air Force One years before any of the kids here were born. The engines had been removed and the presidential seal painted over, but you could still see a shadow of the emblem beneath the paint. Connor climbs the stairs with a bag of tools, hoping that whatever it is, he can get in and out quickly. Like everyone else, he has a morbid curiosity about the man, and he wonders what an old presidential jet looks like on the inside. But being under the Admiral's scrutiny scares the hell out of him. He steps through the hatch to find a couple of kids tidying up. They're younger kids that Connor doesn't know. He thought the Goldens might be in here, but they're nowhere to be seen. As for the jet, it's not nearly as luxurious as Connor had expected. The leather seats have tears, the carpet is almost worn through. It looks more like an old motorhome than Air Force One. Where's the Admiral? The Admiral steps out from the deeper recesses of the jet. Although Connor's eyes are still adjusting to the light, he can see the Admiral is holding a weapon.
Connor! I'm glad you could make it.
Connor winces at the sight of the gun, and at the realization the Admiral knows him by name.
What do you need that for?
Connor asks, pointing at the gun.
Just cleaning it, says the Admiral.
Connor wonders why he would still have a clip in a gun he was cleaning, but decides it's best not to ask. The Admiral puts the gun into a drawer and locks it. Then he sends the two kids off and seals the hatch behind them. This is exactly the kind of situation Connor feared most, and he can feel a rush of adrenaline begin to tingle in his fingers and toes. His awareness becomes heightened.
You need me to fix something, sir?
Yes, I do. My coffee maker.
Why don't you just take one from the other planes?
Because, says the Admiral calmly, I prefer to have this one repaired.
He leads Connor through the jet, which seems even larger on the inside than out, filled with cabins, conference rooms, and studies.
You know, your name comes up quite often, the Admiral says.
This is news to him, and not welcome news either.
Why?
First for the things you repair, then for the fighting.
Connor senses a reprimand on the way. Yes, he's had fewer fights here than usual, but the Admiral is a man of zero tolerance.
Sorry about the fighting.
Don't be. Oh, there's no question that you're a loose cannon, but more often than not, you're aimed in the right direction.
I don't know what you mean, sir.
From what I can see, each fight you've engaged in has resolved one problem or another. Even the fights you lose. So even then, you're fixing things.
He offers Connor that white-toothed smile. Connor shudders. He tries to hide it, but he's sure the Admiral sees it. They come to a small dining room and galley.
Here we are, says the Admiral.
The old coffee maker sits on a counter. It's a simple device. Connor's about to pull out a screwdriver to open up the back when he notices that it's not plugged in. When he plugs it in, the light comes on and it starts to gurgle out coffee into the little glass pot.
Well, how about that?
Says the Admiral with another of his terrible grins.
I'm not here for the coffee maker, am I?
Have a sheet,
the Admiral says.
I'd rather not.
Have one anyway,
That's when Connor sees the picture. There are several photos up on the wall, but the one that captures Connor's attention is of a smiling kid about his age. The smile looks familiar. In fact, it looks exactly like the Admiral's smile. It's just like Roland had said. Now Connor wants to bolt, but Reese's voice is in his head again, telling him to scan his options. Sure, he can run. Chances are he can get to the hatch before the Admiral can stop him, but opening the hatch won't be easy. He could hit the Admiral with one of his tools. That might give him enough time to get away, but where would he go? Beyond the graveyard, there's just desert, desert, and more desert. In the end, he realizes his best choice is to do as the Admiral says. He sits down.
"You don't like me, do you?" says the Admiral.
Connor won't meet his gaze.
"You saved my life by bringing me here."
"You will not avoid answering this question. You don't like me, do you?"
Connor shudders once more, and this time doesn't even try to hide it.
"No, sir, I don't."
"I want to know your reasons."
Connor lets out a single rueful chuckle as his answer.
"You think I'm a slave dealer," says the Admiral, "and that I'm using these unwinds for my own profit."
"If you know what I'm going to say, why ask me?"
"I want you to look at me."
But Connor doesn't want to see the man's eyes, or more accurately, doesn't want the Admiral seeing his.
"I said look at me!"
Reluctantly, Connor lifts his eyes and fixes them on the Admiral's.
"I'm looking."
"I believe you are a smart kid. Now I want you to think. Think. I am a decorated Admiral of the United States Navy. Do you think I need to be selling children to earn money?"
"I don't know."
"Think! Do I care about money and lavish things? I do not live in a mansion. I did not vacation on a tropical island. I spend my time in the stinking desert living in a rotting plane 365 days a year. Why do you think that is?"
"I don't know."
"I think you do."
Connor stands up now. In spite of the Admiral's tone of voice, he feels less and less intimidated by him. Whether it's wise or whether it's foolhardy, Connor decides to give the Admiral what he's asking for.
"You do it because of the power. You do it because it lets you keep hundreds of helpless kids in the palm of your hand. And you do it because you can pick and choose who gets unwound and which parts you'll get."
The Admiral is caught off guard by this. Suddenly he's on the defensive.
"What did you say?"
"It's obvious. All the scars and those teeth? They're not the ones you were born with, are they? So what is it you want from me? Is it my eyes or my ears? Maybe it's my hands that can fix things so well. Is that why I'm here? Is it?"
The Admiral's voice is a predatory growl.
"You've gone too far."
"No, you've gone too far."
The fury in the Admiral's eyes should terrify Connor, but his cannon has come loose, and it's beyond locking down.
"We've come to you in desperation. What you do to us is obscene."
"So I'm a monster then?"
"Yes, and my teeth are the proof."
"Yes, then you can have them."
Then the Admiral does something beyond imagining. He reaches into his mouth, grabs onto his own jaw, and rips the teeth out of his mouth. His eyes blazing at Connor, he hurls the hard pink clump in his hand down on the table, where it clatters in two horrible pieces. Connor screams in shock. It's all there. Two rows of white teeth. Two sets of pink gums.
But there's no blood.
Why is there no blood? There's no blood in the Admiral's mouth either. His face seems to have collapsed onto itself. His mouth is just a floppy, puckered hole. Connor doesn't know which is worse, the Admiral's face or the bloodless teeth.
"They're called dentures,"
the Admiral says.
"They used to be common in the days before unwinding. But who wants false teeth when for half the price you can get real ones straight from a healthy unwind? I had to get these made in Thailand. No one does it here anymore."
I don't understand."
Connor looks at the false teeth and jerks his head almost involuntarily toward the picture of the smiling boy. The Admiral follows his gaze.
"That,"
says the Admiral,
was my son. His teeth looked very much like my own at that age, so they designed my dentures using his dental records.
It's a relief to hear an explanation other than the one Roland gave.
I'm sorry.
The Admiral neither accepts nor rejects Connor's apology.
The money I get for placing unwinds into service positions is used to feed the ones who remain, and to pay for the safe houses and warehouses that get runaway unwinds off the street. It pays for the aircraft to get them here, and it pays off anyone who needs bribery to look the other way. After that, the money that remains goes into the pockets of each unwind on the day they turn 18 and are sent out into this unforgiving world. So you see, I may still be, by your definition of the word, a slave dealer, but I am not quite the monster you think I am.
Connor looks to the dentures that still sit there, glistening, on the table. He thinks to grab them and hand them back to the Admiral as a peace offering, but decides the prospect is simply too disgusting. He lets the Admiral do it himself.
"Do you believe the things I've told you today?"
the Admiral asks. Connor considers it, but finds his compass is out of whack. Truth and rumors, facts and lies are all spinning in his head so wildly he still can't say what is what.
"I think so," says Connor.
"No so," says the Admiral, "because you will see things today more awful than an old man's false teeth. I need to know that my trust in you is not misplaced."
Half a mile away in aisle 14, space 32, sits a FedEx jet that has not moved since it was towed here more than a month ago. The Admiral has Connor drive him to the jet in his golf cart, but not before retrieving the pistol from his cabinet as a precaution. Beneath the starboard wing of the FedEx jet are five mounds of dirt marked by crude headstones. These are the five who suffocated in transit. Their presence here makes this truly a graveyard. The hatch to the hold is open. Once they've stopped, the Admiral says,
"Climb inside and find crate number 2933, and come out again and we'll talk."
"You're not coming?"
"I've already been."
The Admiral hands him a flashlight.
"You'll need this."
Connor stands on the roof of the cart, climbs through the cargo hatch, and turns on the flashlight. The moment he does, he has a shiver of memory. It looks exactly the same as it did a month ago. Open crates and overtones of urine. The afterbirth of their arrival. He works his way deeper into the jet, passing the crate that he, Hayden, Emby, and Diego had occupied. Finally, he finds number 2933. It was one of the first crates to be loaded. Its hatch is open just a crack. Connor pulls it all the way open and shines his light in. When he catches sight of what's inside, he screams and reflexively lurches back, banging his head on the crate behind him. The Admiral could have warned him, but he hadn't.
"Okay, okay, I know what I saw. There's nothing I can do about it, and nothing in there can hurt me."
Still, he takes time to prepare himself before he looks in again. There are five dead kids in the crate, all 17-year-olds. There's Amp and Jeeves. Beside them are Kevin, Melinda, and Raul, the three kids who gave out jobs his first day there. All five of the Goldens. There are no signs of blood, no wounds. They could all be asleep except for the fact that Amp's eyes are open and staring at nothing. Connor's mind reels. Did the Admiral do this? Is he mad after all? But why would he? No, it has to have been someone else. When Connor comes out into the light, the Admiral is paying his respects to the five kids already buried beneath the wing. He straightens the markers and evens out the mounds.
"They disappeared last night. I found them sealed in the crate this morning," the Admiral tells him. "They suffocated, just like the first five did. It's the same crate."
"Who would do this?"
"Who indeed?"
says the Admiral. Satisfied with the graves, he turns to Connor.
"Whoever it is took out the five most powerful kids, which means whoever did this wants to systematically dismantle the power structure here, so that they can rise to the top of it more quickly."
There's only one unwind Connor knows of who might be capable of this,
But even so, he has a hard time believing Roland would do something this horrible.
I was meant to discover them, the Admiral says. They left my golf cart here this morning so that I would. Make no mistake about it, Connor. This is an act of war. They have made a surgical strike. These five were my eyes and ears among the kids here. Now I have none.
The Admiral takes a moment to look at the dark hole of the hold.
Tonight, you and I will come back here to bury them.
Connor swallows hard at the prospect. He wonders who he pissed off in heaven to get singled out to be the Admiral's new lieutenant.
We'll bury them far away, says the Admiral, and we will tell no one that they're dead, because if word of it gets out, the culprits will have their first victory. If someone does start talking, and they will, we'll track the rumors down to the guilty party.
And then what? Connor asks.
And then justice will be served. Until then, this must be our secret.
As Connor chauffeurs him back to his plane, the Admiral makes his business with Connor clear.
I need a new set of eyes and ears, someone to keep me abreast of the state of things among the Unwinds, and someone to ferret out the wolf in the herd. I'm asking you to do this for me.
So you want me to be a spy?
Whose side are you on? Are you on my side, or the side of whoever did this?
Connor now knows why the Admiral brought him here and forced him to see this for himself. It's one thing to be told, and another one entirely to discover the bodies. It makes it brutally clear to Connor where his allegiance must lie.
Why me? Connor has to ask.
The Admiral gives him his white-dentured smile.
Because you, my friend, are the least of all evils.
The next morning, the Admiral makes an announcement that the Goldens were sent off to organize new safe houses. Connor watches Roland for a reaction, perhaps a grin or a glance at one of his buddies. But there's nothing. Roland gives no telltale sign that he knows what really happened to them. In fact, throughout the morning announcements, he seems disinterested and distracted, like he can't wait to get on with his day. There's a good reason for that. Roland's apprenticeship with Cleaver, the helicopter pilot, has been paying off. Over the past weeks, Roland has learned to fly the helicopter like a pro, and when Cleaver isn't around, he offers free rides to those kids he feels deserve it. He says Cleaver doesn't care, but more likely he just doesn't know. Connor had assumed that Roland would offer rides to his own inner circle of kids, but that's not the case. Roland rewards work well done, even by kids he doesn't know. He rewards loyalty to one's team. He lets other kids vote on who should get a chance to do a flyby of the yard in the helicopter. In short, Roland acts as if he's the one in charge and not the Admiral. When the Admiral is present, he feigns obedience. But when others are gathered around him, and there are always others gathered around Roland, he takes every opportunity to cut the man down.
The Admiral's out of touch, he would say. He doesn't know what it's like to be one of us. He can't possibly understand who we are and what we need.
And in groups of kids he's already won over, he whispers his theories about the Admiral's teeth and his scars and his diabolical plans for all of them. He spreads fear and distrust, using it to unite as many kids as he can. Connor has to bite his lip to keep himself quiet when he hears Roland mouth off, because if he speaks out in defense of the Admiral, then Roland will know which side of the line he's on. There's a recreation jet at the graveyard, near the meeting tent. Inside there are TVs and electronics, and under its wings are pool tables, a pinball machine, and reasonably comfortable furniture. Connor proposed setting up a water mister so that the area beneath the wings will stay at least a little bit cooler during the heat of the day. But even more importantly, Connor figures the project will allow him to be a fly on the wall, hearing conversations, cataloging clicks, and performing general espionage. The problem is, Connor is never a fly on the wall. Instead, his work becomes the center of attention. Kids offer to help him like he's Tom Sawyer painting a fence. They all keep seeing him as a leader when all he wants is to be ignored. He's glad that he never told anyone he's the so-called Akron AWOL. According to the current rumors, the Akron AWOL took on an entire legion of juvie cops, outsmarted the National Guard, and liberated half a dozen harvest camps.
He has enough attention from other kids without having to contend with that kind of reputation. While Connor works to install the Mister line, Roland keeps an eye on him from the pool table. He finally puts down the cue and comes over.
"You're just a busy little worker bee, ain't ya?" Roland says, loud enough for all the kids around to hear.
Connor's up on a stepladder, attaching mist piping to the underside of the wing. It allows him the satisfaction of carrying on this conversation while looking down on Roland.
"I'm just trying to make life a little easier," Connor says. "We need a mister down here. Wouldn't want anyone to suffocate in this heat."
Roland keeps a cool poker face.
"It looks like you're the Admiral's new golden boy now that the others have left."
He looks around to make sure he has everyone's attention.
"I've seen you go up to his jet."
"He needs things fixed, so I fix them," says Connor. "That's all." Then, before Roland can push his interrogation, Hayden speaks up from the pool table.
"Connor's not the only one going up there," Hayden says. "There's kids going in and out all the time. Kids with food, kids cleaning. And I hear he's taken an interest in a certain mouth breather we all know and love."
All eyes turn toward Emby, who has become a fixture at the pinball machine since he arrived.
"What?"
"You've been up to the Admiral's, haven't you?" Hayden says. "Don't deny it."
"So?"
"So what does he want? Sure, we'd all like to know." Emby squirms, uncomfortable at the center of anyone's attention.
"He just wanted to know about my family and stuff."
This is news to Connor. Perhaps the Admiral's looking for someone else to help him ferret out the killer. True, Emby's much less visible than Connor, but a fly on the wall shouldn't actually be a fly on the wall.
"I know what it is," says Roland. "He wants your hair."
"Does not?"
"Yeah. His own hair is thinning, right? You got yourself a nice mop up there. The old man wants to scalp you and send the rest of you to be unwound."
"Shut up." Most of the kids laugh. Sure, it's a joke, but Connor wonders how many think Roland might be right. Emby must suspect it himself because he looks kind of sick. It makes Connor furious.
"That's right, pick on Emby," says Connor. "Show everyone just how low you are."
He climbs down off the ladder, facing Roland eye to eye.
"Hey, did you notice Amp left his megaphone? Why don't you take his place? You're such a loudmouth, you'd be perfect for it."
Roland's response comes without the slightest smile.
"I wasn't asked."